Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Garage sales are magic. My mom furnished our house beautifully and cheaply because she knew the right neighborhoods where she could find gorgeous items at garage sales. Antique mirrors for just a couple dollars, fine china, Izod clothing for me and my sisters. This was obviously back in the day. The thrill of a good deal, though, was just as satisfying as obtaining the item itself. Well, the ultimate garage sale may just be the Chelsea Flea Market on Manhattan's West Side. And author Michael Ripps has captured the legacy of that market. It's really a world unto itself in his book, The Golden Flea, A Story of Obsession and Collecting. Michael Ripps, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you, Tenere. It's a pleasure.
Now, before we...
And to be interviewed by someone who loves flea markets.
Yep, you got me. Before we get into the Chelsea Flea Market, what it is and what it was, I just want to get to know you a little better. And if you don't mind, I want to read one of my favorite lines from your book. This is on page 9 there, right at the beginning. You write, "Born in Nebraska, I viewed most objects as contaminated." will you please explain yourself?
So that's really a reference to antiques, rugs, anything that had the aspect, some of the flavor of the old world, particularly Europe. And the reason for that was my uncle was killed in the war. Another uncle was terribly wounded physically and emotionally. And my family, and I think many, many other families in Nebraska, wanted to wash themselves of the kind of objects that had an association with Europe and the struggles that their generation and the previous generation had with the two world wars. So people who had foreign accents tried to suppress that, and everybody was trying to start anew. And that expressed itself in sort of the absence of objects, and again, particularly objects that were from a different generation or a different country. And I really only began going to flea markets, what you call tag sales, when I came to the East Coast.
Right. Tag sales, garage sales. So the Chelsea Flea Market, I mean, it has been around a long time. It is still there today. But it seems to me to be different from what you describe in the book. What's changed?
Indeed it is. When I first started going to the flea market, which was sort of the height of the Chelsea Flea Market, there were hundreds of vendors spread across open parking lots and empty warehouses throughout Chelsea. When the price of real estate in Chelsea soared, those empty parking lots and warehouses became expensive apartment buildings. Consequently, the hundreds of flea markets, vendors, thousands of those vendors shrunk to one, what is essentially one very large open lot between 25th Street between Broadway and 6th Avenue. But I should say a lot of the vendors moved into some of the buildings where there's sort of arcades of vendors. Consequently, the flea market is still there. It's dispersed. It's harder to find a number of the vendors. But in many ways, it has the same excitement and mystery that the flea market of old had.
I want you, just for nostalgia's sake, though, to just paint a picture of the garage. Because to me, the garage in your book, The Golden Flea, it almost has its own personality. So if I went with you in the heyday of the Chelsea Flea into the garage, what would I see?
The garage was, as you say, the heart of the Chelsea Flea. And what you would see would be an assembly of about roughly 200 vendors on two floors. And those vendors would be selling everything Tenery from, $3 or $4 items to $10,000 and $20,000 items. And the pricing of the various items was, to a large extent, irrational. The people were even more irrational. And amongst the vendors, this welter of vendors, you'd also find this class of characters called the pickers. And then you had people who came to the flea market not really to buy at the flea market, but to perform at the flea market, to be seen at the flea market. It became theater for the students at the Fashion Institute of Technology, which was just to the north. You had editors and from various fashion magazines. You have club kids who at 7 in the morning were just getting out from the clubs the night before. And it was a center of sort of performance art, spontaneous performance art. And it was just fascinating.
Well, that sounds a lot more fun than cruising the McDonald's on Main Street that I did as a teenager. So it doesn't sound like there was a typical vendor at the flea market.
Oh, not at all. There was a typical mentality, I think, amongst the vendors, but biographically, the vendors were wildly different. It's interesting because flea market vendors have, at least in New York, have a terrible reputation. They're kind of considered slightly grifterish. They have the reputation of making up stories about the objects they're selling and about themselves. There was one, for example, Paul, who had every Saturday and Sunday, he had this small rack of clothing, of women's clothing and men's clothing. And if you ask him about one of the articles on his rack, which would be seemingly a normal sort of blouse, woman's blouse, he would tell you that actually the blouse that you picked out was a Lily Pulitzer blouse that she had made for Jackie Kennedy. And that Jackie Kennedy, you know, had worn it and then given it as a gift to a member of his family because his family was very close to the Kennedys. And so the price, of course, with that sort of provenance was outrageous. It was like, you know, $300 for this blouse with this story. And nobody ever believed him. And in part, you might actually buy the blouse just for this fictional story.
At least visit his booth to get a fictional story. I think it'd be worth it.
Or at least visit it. And he was so wonderfully arrogant, right? He was so wonderfully arrogant. He would decide that, you know what? His clothing was too good for a particular customer. So no price was high enough.
No.
Right? He just, if he didn't like a customer, he wasn't gonna sell them the article. And absolutely, Tannery, there was no negotiation. I tell the story in the book of one person who came up and asked him how much a sweater was. And he said, well, the sweater is $80. And she looked at him and she said, you know, it's an ordinary sweater. She said, couldn't you give me a better price? And he said, okay, $100. And she said, that's a better price. And he said, for me, it is. And he had rules. So you couldn't just buy if you wanted to buy the article and he was willing to sell it to you, it came with a rule. So he would only sell it to you if you understood from him what the proper time for wearing this particular article was. Mm-hmm. And one of the rules of clothing, I remember him telling me was, he said, there's only one time in a man's life when he should wear an ascot. And I tried to get the answer to that from him when that one time was. And, you know, he was vague. He didn't want to tell me. He said, I would learn the answer one day. Well, one day I did learn the answer, and it came about 10 years later, which was about 3 or 4 years after he had disappeared from the flea market, and I got a notice that he had passed away. And I was invited to a ceremony for his funeral. And I went to the ceremony, and I'm sitting in this little church in Connecticut, and the people who got up to talk about him were not other people from the flea market, though there were a couple of those, but rather people who had the last names Kennedy and Rothschild and Vanderbilt.
Really?
And exactly. And they were all people who he had grown up with and whom his family had known. And I also learned...
Were they all wearing ascots?
Well, no, because they knew the one time to wear an ascot.
So it wasn't a funeral.
And it wasn't a funeral. And what was revealed to me, ultimately, by this man, was that the one time when a man wears an ascot is when he decides to put a belt around his neck and hang himself from a door. Because when you put the ascot around your neck, when you hang yourself as this man had done, the burn marks from the belt won't show and therefore be disturbing to the people at your funeral.
And oh my goodness. So this man, Paul
wore an ascot exactly when he killed himself.
Oh my goodness.
And he did indeed disclose to me, the reasons behind that rule and when a man was to wear an ascot.
Oh my goodness. What a story.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. He was an extraordinary. Anyway, so you have people like Paul, and then you have, you know, people who go, or, you know, or sort of people who grew up in the countryside and go around to tag sales or yard sales, and then drive into the middle of New York City at 5 a.m. to set up in the flea market. So it's really, you know, Tenery, and maybe you experience this, the wonderful thing about the flea market was what the surrealists in Paris loved about the Paris flea market in the 20s and 30s, which was that the mixture of people and objects was like a dream. It was like a dreamscape. And it inspired the imagination. And I think that ultimately is the wonderful thing about flea markets, is just it becomes an inspiration. It takes you into a magical world. You transcend the, you know, your everyday experience and expectations.
Well, and there's a character in the book, I mean, a real person in the book named Andrew, and you talk about transformation and being inspired. I wonder if you would share his story, because that's really kind of what brought him there.
That's interesting. What engaged you about that story? I'm curious.
Well, he gave up a very lucrative career, as I understand it, right?
Indeed.
And then he ends up as a vendor at the Chelsea Flea.
Exactly. He was a tremendously successful banker. He had decided one day to drop off some of his very expensive clothing that no longer fit him at a Goodwill shop. And he found, between the kind of catharsis of giving away his clothing and what he saw in the Goodwill, that this is what he wanted to do. He wanted to essentially purchase, find expensive items, and then redistribute them to people in the flea market. And he was
kind of... That's a very interesting way to practice charity, I would say.
Yes. And he became kind of a spiritual leader of of the flea market. You know, it was... And he transformed himself, and, you know, ultimately he ended up pretty much living in a small one room apartment at the Chelsea Hotel, and then ultimately ended up living on the street for a while.
Wow.
But he would tell you, if you met him now, and you might if you come to the Chelsea Flea, that he is much happier than he was ever before, particularly when he was a wealthy banker in Boston.
Now, I want to meet one other vendor, and I think his name is Jocko. Tell me if I'm saying that right. And the reason I want to talk about him is because it seems like there's an affinity that you have personally with him.
Yes, a terrible affinity.
Can you tell us about that?
So the thing about the vendors, and I think Jocko is the most representative of this, is that they have a kind of fetishistic, emotional, personal relationship with a lot of the objects that they encounter. And if you talk to these vendors about where their objects came from, often they'll say, you know, I have had this in my home for 10 years, or this is a painting that was in the wall of my, you know, study or bedroom, whatever. And came to me to be an insight into what's popularly referred to as hoarding, a condition which I undoubtedly suffer from. And so Jocko is the most extreme example of this. And Tenery, if you come to New York, which I urge you to do, we will go visit Jocko's lair. He has.
Is he still at the Chelsea Flea?
I ran into him just last weekend.
Okay.
And he has basically a large old building with no water, no heat in downtown Newark that's three floors of what anybody else would describe as junk. And people would, I think psychiatrists would say, he's a classic hoarder. But if you went through his junk, as I have with him, and it's floor to ceiling, often inaccessible piles of things, he has a relationship with those things. He has sort of some sort of emotional tie to those things, as many African members of African tribes do to ritualistic objects.
That's a lot of relationships.
Yes. And so, yeah, it's a frightening amount of relationships. Indeed. And so unlike people who are selling, you know, from Best Buy, the kind of big stores that you're used to, these vendors have their personalities, their emotions are to a very large extent tied to their objects. And in a way, they probably are closer emotionally to a lot of their objects than they are to other people.
Well, that relationship is
fascinating to me.
Yeah. Now, you said you have the same problem. So do you kind of go visit that warehouse and go, maybe I need to take stock of my life and reconsider my relationship with things? I mean, have you done any therapy after having, you know, especially researched and written this book?
Yes. And as a result of researching and writing this book and this extraordinary structure and warehouse junkyard that is Jocko's cave, I actually have been over the last year attempting to clean out my own warehouse of junk. but it's a real question of what our relationship to objects really is, and whether or not at some level we may not have an instinct to have the kind of connection to objects that you see in certain tribal cultures.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Michael Ripps. He's the author of The Golden Flea, A Story of Obsession and Collecting. You mentioned pickers, and these are the people who are buying things, and they're trying to do so in a very, you know, intelligent way because they're making money off of off of the exactly. items that they buy. So tell us about a couple of the pickers you met and what made them interesting.
So the pickers wander through the flea market. They're kind of the invisible class of people in the flea, and they are so. One of them is a fellow in the book I call the Prophet, and he will spend Monday through Friday with piles of museum catalogs, auction catalogs, textbooks, and what he will do is he will go through the index of those volumes or the table of contents, and he will simply attempt to be absorbing as many names and artistic styles as he possibly can. So that when he goes into the flea markets first thing in the morning, you know, Saturday morning at 6 o'clock, and he sees something, intuitively it will click as being a first generation constructivist sculpture from, you know, Germany or Russia, right?
So he's almost like a scholar.
Oh yes. These people, as a result of what they do, have the best eyes in the country. They have their eyes with respect to objects, paintings, sculptures, pretty much anything, porcelains, is so far superior to anybody at a museum that you can imagine. I mean, it is
because they're almost like picking a needle out of a haystack. They have to sort through so much junk to get to the prize.
Price, exactly. They look at, on any given week, they look at 5,000 objects, whether it's in thrift shops, Goodwill, the flea market, etc. They are looking at the incredible haystack of objects in New York City. And they only are able to eat if they can pick out the needles. And so they, over 10, 20, 30, sometimes 50 years, have become absolutely extraordinary at identifying important objects.
There's another.
And those are the people I go to if I have any question. Or if anybody goes to a flea market and they have any question about whether something's real or not real, whether it's a drawing or a print, whether it was made in, you know, 1850 or it's a reproduction from 1940, just ask one of the vendors, who are the pickers here? Point out a picker. Go to the picker, say, what's the story on this? And they'll probably be dead right.
Okay, so the vendors get to know who the pickers are. And so it seems like, if you were a picker and you could change your appearance every day, that might be the best thing, because if a picker comes to you and they want something, it's, you might kind of say, oh, maybe I'm not charging enough for this. Maybe they know something that I don't know.
Exactly. And there's certain vendors who won't allow certain pickers into their booths at the flea market. There's a tension between the vendors, and the pickers. Absolutely. And many pickers will try to go to different flea markets in the area so that they won't be remembered when they come back to a flea market. They won't be there necessarily every weekend.
I see. Yeah. I'd like to meet one more picker if I think we have time for that. Can you tell me about another of your favorite characters?
Yes. One of the pickers I met, and pickers tend to be pretty specific in what they're looking for. They can't absorb all the information they need to cover every conceivable object and period. So they tend to be focused. One picker, for example, I met, very sweet old man, wear a cowboy hat. He was about 5 foot tall and walked with a limp, and he collected these delicate beads, which were metal beads, which were handmade in Europe in the 18th and 19th century and were used on women's dresses. Well, the beads have become valuable since then, and sometimes people will pay up to $1,000 for a particular bead from the 17th or 18th century. And for the most part, those are overlooked in the flea market. So that's what he's looking for. One day I'm talking to one of the vendors about this fellow and this fellow's interest in beads. And the vendor said, "Oh, stay away from him. You know, he's a murderer."
What?
Exactly what I said. So one day this fellow, this picker, and I are having lunch, and he's barely able to walk. And I say to him, "You know, funny thing happened. I'm having conversation with one of the vendors, and he accused you of being a murderer." At which point, this picker told me the story that when he came to New York, he started a group called the Black Mask. And the Black Mask was a group of radical artists who attacked museums and other establishments and certain artists for being too commercial. They were essentially Bolsheviks. And what he published a magazine, now quite valuable, called The Black Mask. And the magazine had such popularity that he decided to hire somebody to help write it. And it was this homeless woman whom he had met, and he brought her in to do some writing for the Black Mask. She was very clever. And ultimately, she moved in with him. One day, she's sitting with him in the office, and she says to him, "Who do you think the most offensive artist, living artist, is?" And my friend says, "Well, you know, Andy Warhol. He's the biggest sellout of all of the artists. He's the one who's most craven." Mm. And she said, "That's what I thought you would say." She stands up and walks out. About, I don't know, an hour or two later, he gets a call from one of his friends who said, "Have you heard that your roommate just shot Andy Warhol?"
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
At which point, the FBI sets out to find my friend because they think he put her up to shooting Andy Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
Before the FBI gets there, he gets in his car and he starts driving. And he drives across the country, through the Midwest, up into the mountains, drives as far up into the Rocky Mountains as he can, abandons his car, and begins to walk.
That looks like a guilty person to me.
Yeah. He walks up until he finds a Native American village, and he stays in that village with the Native Americans for the next 30 years.
Really? This story is incredible.
It's in the book. He then after 30 years in the village, he leaves the village. He starts a little farm not far from the village. And after, I don't know, 10 or 15, 20 years of farming, he decides to come back to the East Coast. And he starts making money when he comes back to New York City by picking at the flea market. And he focuses on these metal beads. And that's when I meet him.
Mm.
And he's there to this day. You can come to the Chelsea Flea Market and you will see this man wandering around. And now he's actually a little bit of a celebrity. because of his this group that he founded back in the 60s, the Black Mask. Hmm.
If you're just joining us, this is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and our guest is Michael Ripps. He's the author of The Golden Flea, A Story of Obsession and Collecting. In just a moment, we're going to hear about some secret auctions at the Chelsea Flea. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Our guest this hour is Michael Ripps. He's the author of The Golden Flea, A Story of Obsession and Collecting. Secret auctions, Michael Ripps.
Indeed. I noticed at a certain point, Tenery, when I was at the Flea, that every Sunday morning around 10 o'clock, there would be a migration of the pickers. Oh. Out of the Flea. And I was curious about that and asked a couple of the pickers about it. And they said, well, you know, nothing for you to think about. Don't worry about it. It's probably just a coin. Ultimately, when I became close friends with them, and it took a number of years, they told me that where they were all going and where they took me was to a secret auction just off of the Chelsea Flea. And at that auction, there was a fellow by the name of David Killen, who would stand behind a glass counter. And David Killen was known for having a particularly good eye for objects. And he had set up every Sunday morning between, 10 and 12, this secret auction in an abandoned warehouse. And he would just pull things from behind the counter that no one had seen before. And this group of pickers would start bidding on the object. And the bidding could be from, again, it could be $10, it could be $100,000. And you would have to bid without examining the object. And it was just you looking at the object as he held it in his hands for the first time. And just on the force of your own instincts, place a bid. And often those bids, as I say, were substantial.
Did they ever let you bid?
Ultimately, I was allowed to bid, which I considered a great honor. Seeing this sort of accumulation of pickers was quite eye opening, because the pickers tend to be a really peculiar group of people. Mm-hmm. There was one person named Bobby at the auction, and a glass vase came up, and Bobby bids $50 for the object. Someone else bids $75. Bobby bids $100. And there are no other bidders. So David is about to hammer down the object for Bobby for $100. Just as he's about to do so, Bobby calls out $150. Right?
Hmm.
Exactly. So David says, well, Bobby, you want to bid $150? Fine. $150 going once. Bobby yells out $500.
Okay. What's going on?
Bobby is bidding against himself. Ultimately, he buys it for $1,000.
And he had it for $100. Yeah.
One day, a couple months later, I run into Bobby and I say, Bobby, if you don't mind my asking, why did you bid this up against yourself to $1,000? And he said, Michael, did you see the object? He said, it was a beautiful object, and I wanted to make the point to the others in the auction who weren't bidding on it that they should have paid attention to that object, that there was something about that object that was particularly special, and I was willing to pay an extra $1,000 to make that point. And that gets back to what you and I were talking about with respect to the kind of the emotional commitment and exchange that people in the flea have with respect to objects. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Often there are people like Paul and the other picker, the cowboy, who have not particularly easy social relations. And they find some comfort and some real relationship to objects.
I'm glad you brought up Paul, because we're almost out of time, but I want to end with a very special story about Paul and your daughter.
Yes. Paul, as kind of arrogant and sort of strange and fictitious as people assumed him to be, and consequently kind of stayed away from him, he had a real affection for my daughter, and he had a real affection for children. And what people didn't know was that when Paul wasn't peddling from this little place in the flea market that he had, during the week he was teaching underprivileged kids how to read and write. Mm. And that manifests itself in an affection, as I say, that he had for my daughter. And in one of my earliest meetings with Paul, there was a woman's blouse that was, according to Paul, very special. It may have been indeed worn by Jackie Kennedy.
Now we know that was true.
Yeah, and Paul, who could refuse to sell things for thousands of dollars that people were offering him, often would give things away, and the same object. And one day he wrapped up one of these blouses and gave it to me and said, one day give this to your daughter. And if I'm gone and she asks about me, you should give it to her. That's the time. And he said to me, and when you do, which I did after his funeral, 10 years later, and I said to him, what should I say to her? He said to me, when you finally give it to her, tell her it's from Paul from the flea market. That's how he identified himself ultimately. He was part of this place, and this place was the one thing that gave, any sort of profound meaning to him in his life.
Such great stories, and there's so many more. Michael Ripps, thank you for spending time with us here on Constant Wonder. I appreciate it.
Teneri, a great pleasure. And if you ever come to New York, will you give me a call?
Don't tempt me. New York is one of my favorite places.
Okay, I'm at the Chelsea Hotel. Just
Michael Ripps.
Call me up.
Michael Ripps is the author of The Golden Flea, A Story of Obsession and Collecting. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Teneri Taylor.
If you've been to a flea market or two, you quite probably have seen some truly awful paintings, quite possibly in some equally awful Rococo frames. If it's a special kind of bad art that tells a particular kind of story, Louise Riley Sacco might just snap it up and put it in her museum. The Museum of Bad Art is where we're headed next on Constant Wonder. Welcome back now to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Some pieces of art are too bad to be ignored. That's the slogan of the Museum of Bad Art. Louise Riley Sacco is the permanent acting interim executive director of this museum in Somerville, Massachusetts. And here's part of a conversation with her where she explains a bit of what they're up to.
Scott Wilson is an arts and antiques dealer in Boston. Scott found a painting leaning on somebody's pile of trash, and the painting was pretty bad. He was planning to throw the painting out and clean up the frame and sell it. And his good friend, my brother Jerry Riley, saw the painting and said, "You can't throw that out. That's so bad, it's good." And Jerry hung it in his house over the mantelpiece. And then Scott and other friends kept an eye out for other really bad paintings to give Jerry. And he ended up with a small collection. So he put together a party that was going to be called the opening of the Museum of Bad Art. It was going to be just one night. And we painted his basement white and put in some track lights and hung these paintings. And importantly, we spent some time interpreting each of the paintings and writing a little museum-type blurb to hang beside it. So maybe 50 people were invited to the party. And by midnight, there were about 200 people in his house because people kept calling others and saying, you have got to come and see this. And the next morning, five of us said, well, we have to find a way to keep this going. And it took us a little while to figure it out, but it's still going.
Well, this original event, part of the origin story that led to this long history now of the Museum of Bad Art, this event, how much of it was I don't know how to say this, a spoof or gag or tongue-in-cheek. Was at that point, were you just having fun with the idea, or was there some strain of seriousness in the endeavor?
The strain of the serious thought that was there was we kept saying, we love these pieces. You know, we love these works, and nobody seems to pay attention to that. And we questioned it a lot, with the five of us saying, you know, is this just us? Are we kind of out of the mainstream here? And somebody had an insight that if you're walking past a gallery, an art gallery, with a group of people, and someone says, wow, look at that, until you turn around, you don't know if it's really good or really bad. But either way, there is that instinct to share it, and it gets people talking and smiling and having fun.
So is that the single criterion in place for – I mean, there's got to be lots of ways to filter and sift the candidates for the collection. And maybe that's just the starting point, that somebody's going to say, wow, look at this.
Oh, yeah, that is a starting point. There are a couple – we have some clear-cut criteria and some not quite as well-defined. And one thing is that the word art is in our title. So for us, it needs to be art. And what we mean there is it needs to be sincere. It needs to be trying to communicate something. If somebody tries to slap together a piece for the Museum of Bad Art, we're going to see right through it that, you know, it doesn't have that heart and soul in it. So it needs to be art. Something must have gone wrong in a way that makes it interesting or compelling or gets people talking, asking questions. Can't be just boring. And that really has helped us narrow it down. But then the other less well-defined criteria is, like every museum, what's museum-worthy here is whatever the curator says is museum-worthy.
That very first painting in the collection is the one you mentioned that was out on the street edge against a trash can. I want to talk a little bit about that because that painting has quite a touching story behind it. And
it does.
Yeah. I mean, this really was sincerely an effort to memorialize a person in a portrait.
We call it Lucy in the Field with Flowers, and it's a painting of an older woman in a field of flowers with a blue dress on, and a couple of things make it quite interesting. The wind is blowing in two directions at once in different parts of the picture. It's not clear if she's sitting or standing. There seems to be a chair behind her, but then she also looks like she's standing, and the sky is yellow. So this was our first painting, and we ended up getting a lot of press in the Entertainment Weekly newspapers in Boston. And this painting was on the front page of one of these weeklies. We got a phone call from a woman who said, when I saw that painting, I spit my soda out my nose. She said, that's my Nana. And she told us the whole story, that Nana had died, and Auntie, who had been living with Nana, was bereft. So the nieces and nephews got together and hired an artist to paint a picture of Nana from two different photographs. And we've now seen the photographs, and it explains a lot, because in one photograph, Nana's sitting, and in another, she's standing. So that explains that. Susan Lawler, who was the person who contacted us, was able to explain why the sky was yellow. When they questioned the artist about that, the artist said, well, you said that Nana's favorite color was blue, and you wanted her in a blue dress, so I couldn't have a blue sky. This was around the time that we were getting ready to publish a book with this painting on the cover. And once that came up, Susan's cousins and aunts and uncles bought about 50 copies of the book, and we're still in touch with them because this year we put together some pandemic masks with Lucy, as we call her, Lucy in the Field, on the masks, and they bought about 50 of those masks with their Nana. And as this has gone on over the years, we have so many stories like that that often after the fact we find the backstory, and it's they're lovely.
Well, when I saw the painting, I immediately had some associations with other artwork I've seen in the past. And of course, we've, you know, after you've been on this planet a while, you've seen a few portraits. But one painting came to mind immediately, and I had to Google that one and look it up. It's a very well-known painting. I believe it's called Christina's World by Andrew Wyeth.
Yes.
And I thought, well, why did I think of that painting? And I looked at them both side by side to compare. Of course, this Christina's World, a young woman, she's not standing. She's not sitting. She's lying down in a field of what looks like rye or wheat out in the prairie with the houses up on the hill and her torso twisted. The more I looked at it, I thought, why should I have made a comparison immediately to that painting? I don't know why.
I know the painting, and I don't see it, but I don't see the connection. But there you go. Another thing that we really like about this is that in this painting, this is a very specific woman. It's not, you know, it's not a generic person. And Susan Lawler, when she got in touch with us, showed us a picture of her wearing Nana's glasses, and they look exactly alike.
I think my point is we can't avoid making comparisons. As I've been scratching my head about this, they both seem to have their legs crossed, and that's it. The Andrew Wyeth figure and Nana, they both have their legs crossed. That's it. But when we make these comparisons, if you see bad art, there's a way to assess it through comparison with good art, is there not?
Oh, yes, always. And we do a lot of that. We've got a series of very short videos on YouTube where we're often comparing works in our collection with the classic works that inspired them or with works that we compare them to on our own. Everyone knows Vermeer's The Milkmaid, this lovely young woman, you know, in a kitchen. And our version of it is has a woman who is probably 60 years older and has a beautiful bouquet of flowers added to the table. It's clearly inspired by The Milkmaid, but it's so different and just fun to look at and think about why the artist made these changes. We think it was to cheer up her environment by giving her flowers.
Well, I started down this road of criteria for assessing what is or what is not going to make it into your collection. And it would be easy to get this wrong and think that it's just really atrocious stuff that's poorly executed. You did talk about sincerity, and sometimes you can help define something by its opposite. So I'm wondering, it can't just be the opposite of fine art necessarily either, can it?
No, it's not. And actually, Mike, our curator, he makes the distinction between important art and MOBA art, which is kind of interesting. But one thing we do often have to try to help people understand is that we're not interested in kitsch. We're not interested in paint by numbers. We're not interested in tourist art or the big paintings that get sold in hotel sales where you buy a painting to match your sofa. You know, children's art, we just have decreed, is never bad. We don't want kids to worry about us trying to grab up something they do. So we have, you know, we have whole wide categories that we just stay away from. And also, you'll see that most of our art is representational. And part of the reason for that is that when you get into abstract images and things like that, there's much less consensus about what is fine art and what isn't. You know, in representational art, there is a lot of consensus. There's some disagreement, but, you know, you can decide you don't like Duchamp, but you're not going to get any wide disagreement that he's a fine artist and has done beautiful work. Once you start with squares of color or spilled paint on a canvas, it just gets harder to define.
There are a number of pieces in the collection at the MOBA which seem to be inspired by very specific paintings, the one you mentioned that's kind of modeled after the Vermeer Milkmaid. But you know, somebody could take, say, Nude Descending a Staircase and do kind of either a parody of it or a knockoff of it or a sincere attempt to do something just like that, where somebody's really putting their heart into it. And I would just imagine that's an incredibly nuanced kind of differentiation you try to do.
Oh, it is. And in fact, Nude Descending a Staircase was the inspiration, we are absolutely sure, for one that we call Elvis Descending a Staircase, which has Elvis in sort of young Elvis, middle-aged Elvis, and a fat old Elvis coming down some stairs. So that one rings true. And Mike, our curator, does a lot of research to try to find these inspirations. And sometimes we miss it. And when we post it on Facebook or add it to our webpage, someone will always remind us that, you know, that this was clearly inspired by this or a copy of that.
We're visiting with Louise Riley Sacco. She is permanent acting interim executive director of the Museum of Bad Art in Somerville, Massachusetts. There is a painting on your website I've seen that it looks like a little naked Barbie doll riding astride a lobster. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I do. It's tell me the name of it. Somebody on a crustacean.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. When I looked at that, I thought, could I do that? Not ride the crustacean, but paint the painting. Would I do that? The more I thought about it, I thought, no, I don't think I could. But would I have come up with the idea? Perhaps. There's got to be a critical mass of capacity on the part of these artists that you're looking at as well, where they pulled it off at some level.
Well, there are two categories. There are works that were done by someone who barely knew which end of the paintbrush to pick up. And you just see this so much heart and soul, and they just didn't know how to get to where they were trying to go. But the emotion is there, and it's engaging. There are others that are done by people with really good skills, and in some cases we've seen other works by the same artist that are terrific. But they had a bad idea, or something just went off. And those are the people that often submit their own works to us. You know, they knew they had a bad day. They knew they didn't do what they were hoping. But if we accept their work, then it's in a museum and we've found them an audience. And if we don't accept their work, they can tell themselves and their friends that, well, I'm not that bad. The Museum of Bad Art turned me down.
Louise Riley Sacco, permanent acting interim executive director of the Museum of Bad Art in Somerville, Massachusetts. You may think that the United States entered World War II on December 7th, 1941. Officially, that's true, but there's more to the story because German U-boats were, of course, on the prowl in the North Atlantic before that date, and all shipping, all transatlantic travel was imperiled, and as it turns out, the U.S. military, before Pearl Harbor, already had a role to play there. There are border wars, cold wars, guerrilla wars, trade wars, and apparently shadow wars, too, as we're going to explain after the news here on Constant Wonder.